Okay, we good to go?
Yep, we're good to go. Over to you.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this 81st webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this series, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. Okay, this month in Old Diary Leaves, we're now in volume 4, Colonel Olcott describes the work of an extraordinary astrologer from Meerut, India, a city north of Delhi, who used a system called Nadi astrology. The ancient text used in this system called Nadi Granthams, you can see it here, were made of ancient palm leaves, which are believed to contain the life stories and destinies of every individual born in India, as foreseen by the Hindu sages thousands of years ago. And Colonel Olcott actually saw this. He had a friend who went to him, a Hindu friend, and he exactly and particularly described his life, not in generalities, but in actual specifics. So it's quite interesting. The unique aspect of Nadi astrology is that it uses thumb impressions to identify the specific palm leaf that corresponds to an individual's life. Evidently, there's walls and walls of these, what you see here, these strung together palm leaves. And with his palm impression, the Nadi astrologer just goes over to the wall, pulls out one of these collections, flips to your particular astrological reading, and begins to interpret it for you. The sages, known as Nadi readers, interpret the information inscribed on these lives to provide insights into a person's past, present, and future. In the 1880s, it was believed that these palm leaves held info on each and every Indian person, but not anyone born in other nations. So, can we get a reader for this, please?
Sure, I'll start. I note that one of our council members received from Meerut about the time a copy of his horoscope as found in the Nadi Granthams of a great astrologer of that place. This was the second case of the kind which came under my notice.
I think it was supposed to be came, yeah.
Yeah, and it is certainly enough to stagger anybody's faith to be told that a stranger can walk into the Brahmin astrologer's house, give him no proper clue to his identity, and within the next few minutes have one of those mysterious old books placed in his own hands, opened at a page where he may read for himself the particulars of his present birth, the name, past and quality of his father, and the chief incidences of his own life. Yet this is alleged to be true, and, if I may believe friends whose social and official positions entitle them to credence, they have had this very experience with the Meerut astrologer. I saw him personally once at the station and saw his collection of books, but he could find nothing in any of them about me, nor Mrs. Besant, I think it was, who was with me.
Thank you, BL. So, next reader, please.
Martha, can you read that, please? Martha?
Yeah, there we go.
Okay.
I then learned a thing not previously known to the public. That is that the Grantham contains only the horoscopes of persons born in India. And within that portion of it known as Bharata Varsha, that is between the Himalayas and the Vindhya range. I should have been glad to have it otherwise, as it would have been a pleasure to have reported to my Western scientific friends the fact that the outline sketch of my life had been found recorded in an ancient work written centuries before the date of my birth. Others have had that experience, so I leave to them the duty of bearing testimony. Meanwhile, if the reader will refer to the Theosophist for December 1887 and the article on Bhrigu Sanhita, he will see a very instructive narrative of Babu Kedar Nath Chatterjee's experience with the Meerut astrologer above mentioned.
Thank you, Martha. So we'll continue this story next month because there's some interesting anecdotes about this guy. So, okay, a quick review. We began our last session with an old commentary description of Fohat. Since this quote is particularly relevant to today's material, let's take a moment to reread it. Could we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
The central sun causes Fohat to collect primordial dust in the form of balls, to impel them to move in converging lines, and finally to approach each other and aggregate from the Book of Dyson. Being scattered in space without order or system, the world germs come into frequent collision until their finer aggregation, after which they become wanderers, comets. Then the battles and struggles begin. The older bodies attract the younger, while others repel them. Many perish, devoured by their stronger companions. Those that escape become worlds.
Thank you. So this is in many ways similar to modern astronomical theories on planetary creation, but with an important difference, being that in the Theosophical description, the interacting substances are primordial substance rather than dense physical substances. We then took a look at the creation story from the Puranas called the Samudra Manthana, or the churning of the ocean of milk, which pits the Suras against the Asuras, which is one of the many versions from Egypt to the Norse legends of the great war in heaven, which we have discussed in the last few sessions. HPB says, all these wars relate to heaven and earth and have a double and often even a triple meaning and esoteric application to things above as to things below. They relate severally to astronomical, theogonical, and human struggles, to the adjustment of orbs and the supremacy among nations and tribes. She then describes the Judeo-Christian version of the war in heaven, wherein Michael and his hosts are pitted against the dragon, Jupiter and Lucifer Venus, resulting in a third of the stars of the rebellious host being hurled down into space. This is, of course, a complete misinterpretation of Lucifer's great sacrifice for humankind, wherein, like Prometheus, he fell into generation in order to bring the light of mind to humanity. We finished our last session with this quote from a bit later in The Secret Doctrine. Since it clearly states the first generation theosophical version of the creation story, which we're going to be studying today. Let's start this session by rereading it. Can we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
From the one life, formless and uncreate, proceeds the universe of lives. First was manifested from the deep, chaos, cold luminous fire, gaseous light, which form the curds in space, irresolvable nebulae, perhaps. These fought, and a great heat was developed by the encountering and collision, which produced rotation. Then came the first manifested material, fire, the hot flames, the wanderers in heaven, comets. Heat generates moist vapor. That forms solid water, question mark. Then dry mist, then liquid mist, watery, that puts out the luminous brightness of the pilgrims, comets, and forms solid watery wheels, matter globes. Bhumi, the earth, appears with six sisters. These produce, by their continuous motion, the inferior fire, heat, and an aqueous mist, which yields the third world element, water. And from the breath of all, atmospheric, air is born. These four are the four lives of the first four periods, rounds, of Manvantara. The three last will follow.
Since we're in the fourth round. Okay, thank you. So any questions so far? By the way, I want to encourage you to ask questions and give your comments on anything that's comes up. So can we get a reader, please? Yes, I see Martha.
It's just a factual question. This is the source of how we understand the Lucifer story, Francis. If somebody says, where did you get the...
You mean this quote here?
Yeah, I come from some traditions where there's this assumption Lucifer was a bad guy.
And exactly. No, this doesn't have anything to do with the Lucifer story directly. This is a kind of a general template as to how creation comes about.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We've actually looked quite a bit at the Lucifer myth over the last many webinars. She keeps referring to it and has additional comments on it. There's a number of references in the Sacred Doctrine about him.
Fine. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay, any others? Any thoughts? Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Like that.
For archaic astronomy and the ancient physical and mathematical sciences express views identical with those of modern science and many of far more momentous import. A struggle for life as a survival of the fittest in the worlds above as on our planet here below, are distinctly taught. This teaching, however, although it would not be entirely rejected by science, is sure to be repudiated as an integral whole, for it avers that there are only seven self-born primordial gods, emanated from the Trinitarian One. In other words, it means that all the world, or sidereal bodies, always on strict analogy, are formed one from the other, after the primordial manifestation at the beginning of the great age is accomplished. The birth of the celestial bodies in space is compared to a crowd or multitude of pilgrims at the festival of the fires. Seven ascetics appear on the threshold of the temple with seven lighted sticks of incense. At the light of these, the first row of pilgrims light their incense sticks.
Thank you, Magda. So first, for archaic astronomy and the ancient physical and mathematical sciences expressed views identical with those of modern science, and many of far more momentous import. In particular, both ancient and modern astronomy agree that the sun and the planets formed through a gradual aggregation of substance. Also, they held in common an awareness of a heliocentric solar system. The ancients' views of quote-unquote far more momentous import would include an awareness of the unseen causes and the formation of process of devas directed by dhyanis and of progressive levels of matter and consciousness that make up the cosmic physical plane. Next, a struggle for life as a survival of the fittest in the worlds above, as on our planet here below, are distinctly taught. Okay, the struggle and fortitude needed to survive physical plane existence only applies to the lower quaternary, whereas the term fittest, when applied to the quote worlds above, represents the ability of the higher form world to continually reject matter of an inferior quality and take on new matter that optimizes the expression of the indweller's consciousness. It's a very different method of quote unquote survival or growth. Next, this teaching, however, although it would not be entirely rejected by science, is sure to be repudiated as an integral whole. To this day, science repudiates the unseen causal levels that initiate all creation. And next, for it avers that there are only seven self-born primordial gods emanated from the Trinitarian One. In other words, it means that all the worlds or sidereal bodies, always on strict analogy, are formed one from the other after the primordial manifestation at the beginning of the Great Age is accomplished. Okay, the it in it avers is referencing archaic astrology. So, you know, archaic astrology avers that there are only seven self-born primordial gods. HPB here attempts to draw a parallel between the esoteric teachings on solar systemic formation and science's theories on the matter. But the only point of similarity is that they both put forward the idea of formation through aggregation. In spite of the similarity, the basis of the two points of view are actually completely different, with science finding cause in the laws of physics and geology, and esotericists placing cause in the will aspect of deity. Next, the birth of the celestial bodies in space is compared to a crowd or multitude of pilgrims at the festival of the fires. Seven ascetics appear on the threshold of the temple with seven lighted sticks of incense. At the light of these, the first row of pilgrims light their incense sticks. So the seven ascetics are the spirits or logoi of the seven sacred planets. The festival of the fires is the hour of solar systemic creation. The pilgrims are the multitude of atoms of consciousness whose destiny it is to manifest in this solar system. The analogy continues in the next passage. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
after which every aesthetic begins whirling his stick around his head in space and furnishes the rest with fire. Thus, with the heavenly bodies, Alea's center is lighted and awakened into life by the fires of another pilgrim, after which the new center rushes into space and becomes a comet. It is only after losing its velocity, and hence its fiery tail, that the fiery dragon settles down to quiet and steady life as a regular, respectable citizen of the sidereal family. Therefore, it is said, born in the unfathomable depths of space, out of the homogeneous element called the world's soul, every nucleus of cosmic matter, suddenly launched into being, begins life under the most hostile circumstances. Through a series of countless ages, it has to conquer for itself a place in the infinitudes.
Thank you. Okay, first, after which every ascetic begins whirling his stick around his head in space and furnishes the rest with fire. In the stanzas of Zion, given in the first pages of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, D.K. describes these ascetics or primordial planets as fiery wheels. Can we get a reader for these excerpts, please?
Yes. Sorry. Marianne, can you read that for us, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Stanza 2, Om, said the Mighty One, and sounded forth the word. The sevenfold waves of matter resolved themselves, and varied forms appeared. Each took its place, each in the sphere ordained. They waited for the sacred flood to enter and to fill. Stanza 3. The great wheel turned upon itself. The seven lesser wheels rushed into being. They revolve like their mother, around, within, and forward. All that existeth was. The wheels were diverse, and in unification, one. As evolved the great wheel, the inner fire burst forth.
Thank you. Any thoughts or questions about this? Okay, next. Thus, with the heavenly bodies, Alaya Center is lighted and awakened into life by the fires of another quote unquote pilgrim, after which the new center rushes into space and becomes a comet. So this idea of comets representing the involutional arc of matter is only found in first generation theosophy. In contradistinction to HBB, DK describes this involutionary phenomena as a sinking of the stone. Actually, I did a search in the blue books, the DK material, and there are no instances whatsoever of the word comet. So it's a different analogy for creation. Can we get a reader for this, please? This just continues on this stanza three. Go ahead.
Scott, please.
Stanza three continued. Faster revolved the greater wheel. Blue, white emerged the flame. The sons of God again came down, and a lesser wheel revolved. Seven times the revolution, and seven times great the heat. More solid grew the formless mass, and deeper sank the stone. To the heart of inmost fire, the sacred stone went down. This time the work was better done, and the product more perfected. At the seventh revolution, the third wheel rendered back the stone. Triple the form, rosy the light, and sevenfold the eternal principle.
Thank you, Scott. Thoughts or questions? Okay.
Hold it.
Okay.
Ariane can't find her hand, but she does apparently have a question. So go ahead, please.
I still have two hands, but I don't have an icon for my hand.
I actually think you do. Someone else has done that. And down at the bottom, if you don't see it, I mean, I see something that says react, and it has the hand that, you know, raise the hand in that. And then I have
I have
a more button, and yes, it says raise hand.
Yeah, it doesn't allow me to I have a more button. It just allows me to chat and show captions. And anyway, maybe I'm not supposed to be raising my hand, but I'll just briefly say.
Now, other people have raised their hand, so it's...
You are supposed to be raising your hand, I guarantee you, Ariane. So just, you know, if any of you have trouble with this, just speak. Say, I have something to say. This isn't that formal, so don't worry about it.
Okay, I have a brief comment. It just seems like the difference here, and I'm not sure I'm understanding everything, mind you, is that it seems like science just ignores the why of what they observe. And so for them, maybe all of this seems very superstitious, that there was like some kind of agency that has will, which we presume that humans have, which we don't really have. We have a nascent will. We have self-will and we pursue our desires ordinarily, but we don't have, you know, develop consciousness, will, or love per se. And it just seems like I could see how this could become very divisive very quickly, because it looks like the theosophical writers are actually superstitious, because they're giving sort of characteristics or aspects to the creator that people presume are human, which are not actually.
Yeah, it's, you mean like, for instance, will, the idea of will, personal will, and the will of the divine?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole discussion. And it's an interesting question. We tend to anthropomorphize the gods. That is, we cast them in our imaginations in our own image. But the sages and the writers of the Ageless Wisdom and the Puranas had a much more direct understanding of these forces. And there are many of these writings that give us a closer understanding of the nature of deity, even though, you know, and finally, and in truth, it's a fool's errand, because we will always reinterpret, no matter what is said, even by the greatest ones, according to our human experience. And which is why I think that seeming mistake appears. But in fact, theosophy tends to, the source of the theosophical writings are from masters of wisdom and above. And so they have a quality of truth to them that you find also in the ancient texts, such as the Puranas. The difference between science and theosophy is just simply science, because of it's very deeply tied to the scientific method. It simply does not recognize that which cannot be measured, which, you know, is the entire realm of the unseen. And that's probably the fundamental difference. Now, there's in our times, there are instances where, for instance, through David Bohm's theories in physics, the quality of the measurable has changed to such an extent that it suggests that the method itself is no longer can really be 100% dependent on, as it was, say, in the time of HBB.
Yeah, just to respond to that, just the irony again of all this, because science relies on the form aspect, measurement, and it assumes that humans can measure, that we are the measure of all things, whether we're accentuating that measurement by machines or not, we're still relying ultimately on our senses, which are so fallible and so questionable. It just seems like there's like a presumption. I haven't studied traditional philosophy enough, but the presumption is that man can be the measure of all things. And that's where this whole thing, this whole dialogue sort of falls apart. When you take that away, something new comes in.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there's a great hubris in the scientific method, you know. But DK is actually really big on science and on the development. And what he says is that with the development/discovery of etheric vision, things are going to change radically. And he predicts that for this century, that more and more people will develop etheric vision, and they will literally see those worlds that have been denied by science. And as a result, ultimately, science will include those new observations because it will become part of the measurable, right? So we may be standing on the cusp of a revolution in how science evolves.
Yeah, I just want to respond to that too. I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The method, the scientific method, is so important because it relates to our observing the outer world, but also self-observation, and to do it in a disciplined way so one could really understand how the microcosm, you know, represents symbolically something of the of godly, of the macrocosm. So I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I know
that its method is not to be lauded. Yeah,
no, I understand where you're coming from. It's just that at this point it's limited to the strictly physically measurable, and that's its ultimate weakness. Thanks for your thoughts, Ariane.
Francis.
Yeah,
I just want to say, you touched on it, but you didn't elaborate on it, because science right now is looking at the physical senses with which to do their metrics and stuff on this. And as we all know, as we evolve, those senses change, you know, from the hearing and the clairaudience and the higher clairaudience to the comprehension and beatitude, and the touch becoming psychometry and planetary psychometry and healing, and then active service, and the sight, the clairvoyance, the higher clairvoyance, the divine vision, and the realization. The taste becomes the imagination, then the discrimination, then the intuition, and then perfection, and the smell, the emotional idealism, the spiritual discernment, the idealism, and then the all knowledge. So as humanity as a whole evolves through the physical, the astral, the mental, the Buddhic, and the atmic planes, they develop the apparatus that they need to, like you mentioned, the etheric vision that we're all supposed to be getting soon. So there's a process for science to move through the plane as humanity as a whole does, and have those better apparatus.
Yeah. And I would just add to the list that you gave that the root of these senses is on the atmic plane, not on the physical. We tend to think, oh, smell, you know, that the sense of, you know, for instance, the sense of taste on the Buddhic plane is the intuition. Well, it's really the other way around, which is the sense of perfection. I think that's, isn't the atmic counterpart to the intuition perfection?
Yeah.
Yeah, the perfection on the physical plane is the sense of taste, you know, that it becomes an effect at the lower levels, not the cause at the lower levels. But we do it the other way around because we can relate to the lower senses so much more strongly than we can to the higher. So we consider them to be the root causal senses when in fact they're the final level of effect. Thank you, Biel. Okay, anyone else? All right. I see Barbara's hand.
Yes, I just want to comment that Dean Radin of the IONS Institute is using the scientific method to study intuition. And one of the things that he is studying is emotion, that people, if there is a strong image coming, people will have a premonition of it before it arrives and have some physiological responses. So it's starting to happen.
Yeah, that's the pioneering that's going on. There's actually many, many people working in that way to bring forth repeatable phenomenon so that it can be recognized as truth. Thank you for that, Barbara. Anyone else?
Anne Veronica says, if I remember well, Barbara Brennan books, Hands of Light, has etheric vision. She could actually see like an X-ray. She was used by NASA, but it hasn't come down to everyday science, and there are not many people yet with this ability.
Mm. Yeah, there's a number of people reported to be able to see sound and hear color, you know, which is a quality attributed to the Deva kingdom and called synesthesia, I believe. And there's many, many people that report this phenomenon. It's just that science doesn't know what to do with it. You know, what does that mean? You can, you know, it's just, there's no framework in the current science model to explain that. So it just sits out there as phenomenon, you know. I think as more of that type of phenomenon is recorded, that there will, certain types, well, probably fifth ray types, will incarnate and create the science that can embrace that phenomena, you know. Albert Einstein famously said, you don't really change old scientists' mind. They just die and new scientists are born, you know. So I think that's what we'll be seeing in the Aquarian Age. Anyone else? Yes, Vivian.
Francis, I think I might have missed something when you opened the session this evening. What is the sacred stone? It says, to the heart of inmost fire, the sacred stone went down.
That's a great question. Very much connected with what's called the philosopher's stone. Well, it's the, you could call it the essence of life, the indweller. And it's going down is its penetration into deeper, deeper levels of the cosmic physical plane. And, you know, if you read stanza two of, which actually I quoted from here, this is the very first words of stanza two. It's actually about three pages long. That's represented by the ellipsis. And he details the method of of descent, of the involutional arc. And so, you know, with each penetration into the lower realms, the sacred stone, being the source of life, you could say, is able to penetrate into a form level at deeper levels. Does that make sense?
Anyway, thank you. I'm surprised it's called a stone.
Yeah, it's also a concept in alchemy, this idea of the sacred stone. And I can't quite tell you exactly why it's called a stone. Of course, we see in the use of it here, for instance, it has to do with the essence. But no, I'm not sure why the term stone has been used. Yes, I see Tom's hand.
Could it be that the stone is the turning point, the mineral kingdom, that it's used as a metaphor for that it's for the outer limit of manifestation?
It could be. It's, you know, there's that connection between the first and the seventh, you know, that suggests the path of the divine into into density. There could be something of it in that, you know. Anyone else? If you know, please raise your hand. Okay, next up. It is only after losing its velocity and hence its fiery tail that the fiery dragon settles down into quiet and steady life as a regular, respectable citizen of the sidereal family. Okay, it's fiery because a product of its fiery physical birth. A dragon because it becomes a planetary logos, a dragon of wisdom. As I mentioned before in DK Theosophy, this early stage is described as the lesser wheels, not as comets. In fact, the word comet, as I mentioned before, doesn't appear in the blue books. But the idea of fiery wheels has a very similar, it seems to be that place between the final product of spheroidal life and the initial phase of the purpose of deity. It's the bridge between the two. Very phohatic in this sense. Phohat is the agency of all of this, by the way. Anyone else?
Tom's hands up again.
Yes, Tom?
Yeah, how do you explain the previous sentence that the Liar Center is lighted and awakened into life by the fires of another pilgrim? I don't quite get it.
Okay, let me go back there so we can. A Liar Center is lighted and awakened into life by the fires of another pilgrim, after which the new center rushes into space. Well, in our solar system, that pilgrim would be one of the septenary, the seven pilgrims that emerge out of the Trinitarian, it's called. The one becomes the three, becomes the seven. And it is, let me see here. I just want to get the exact construction of this. A Liar Center is lighted. That means a primordial but as yet unmanifest. I actually have a little further along. We will reread the Theosophical Glossary's definition of a Liar Center. It's like a zero point from which emerges manifestation, very much connected with Mula Prakriti, which is the sea of fiery substance. But it's you could call it like a portal. So when it's lighted, that means it is activated, so that from it will then lighted and awakened into life by the fires of another pilgrim. This would be one of the seven. After which, the new center rushes into space and becomes a comet. Okay, but the Laya Center itself doesn't rush into space, by the way. The Laya Center stays forever as a subjective reality. From it, what can I say? The intended manifestation rushes into space and becomes a comet. Yeah, and it is a kind of center in itself. You could call it an atom of consciousness, right? So
I understand that. But I was wondering the wording "another pilgrim." You explained it like it would be the other aspects of manifestation, but I read it so that there would be some kind of a polarity, because it's another pilgrim, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. It's like this intermediate stage. You have the subjective Laya Center, which is lighted and awakened into life by the fires. See, this is, I'm not sure why the word another is put there.
The existence of another center, another comet, another star, another planet.
Yeah.
Which all can be seen as pilgrims, maybe?
Yeah, that identifies the pilgrim with the new center. But see, what she seems to be saying is that the Laya Center itself, I think this may be a misuse of the term Laya Center, because she also does it a little further in the text. Where she says that a Laya Center is launched into space. If in that context, what you have is is the idea of the Laya Center being this comet, you know, that evolves into a comet. But if you read the definition of a Laya Center, it always remains at this noumenal level. If you take it at that the Laya Center is noumenal and subjective, and the source, if it itself is awakened into life by the fires of another pilgrim, then this pilgrim would have to be causal to the Laya Center. And I can't quite explain that, sorry. You know, if you look at, you see, pilgrims are often associated with the septenary Prajapatis, the seven that emerge from the one. Those are like, you know, for instance, in when she's talking up here about these aesthetics, see, the birth of Zosima, seven aesthetics appear on the threshold of the temple with seven lighted sticks of incense. The birth of celestial bodies in space compared to a crowd or multitude of pilgrims at the festivals of the fire. Seven aesthetics appear on the threshold of the temple with seven lighted sticks. So we get a sense of the hierarchy here, right? You have the temple, then you have the seven ascetics, which would be the seven Prajapatis. And then every single, you could call it an atom of substance, which, you know, you and I are atoms of substance, right? That have a form and an indweller. So the first row of pilgrims, every one of those atoms of substance is a pilgrim, which lights or has their life lighted by one of the seven ascetics, which are the Panchatari Logoi. And then you get, after which every ascetic, those are again the seven, begins whirling his stick around his head in space. Of course, this is rotation of the planet, and furnishes the rest with fire, all the life within its own form. And then Alaya Center is lighted and awakened in life. Here we are with this. So if we use that definition of pilgrim, this would mean any one of the many lives that is brought to life by the seven, the Prajapatis, the original seven lives. And you, so you have, in a way, this is, you know, the go forth and multiply idea. I think that's what's meant here.
It's kind of the beginning of duality. You need plus and minus, and somehow this is, that comes to my mind.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what's being discussed at this level. So the temple, you could say, is the source of life. And the seven Prajapatis described in Hinduism are that initial differentiation. And I mean, this is in, I think it's stanza 3, verse 5, where he says the one becomes the three, three become the seven become the multitude. And I think that's being described in this, in a different way here. Okay, let's see.
Francis?
Yeah.
Magda says, stone heart, box of karma in our heart, which gets taken from life to life. Also, it could have the same meaning as the bodhisattva, bodhisattva's compassion. And also, would the heart of our earth chain, or be the earth globe, for?
If you're relating it to the stone, you know, what something occurred to me while you were reading that is that one of the names of a seed and a fruit is a stone or a pit, and it holds the source of life, and yet it's the densest part of the fruit, you know. And you know, that would relate to the idea that the fourth globe is the quote unquote heart of the seven, you know, the fourth. And of course, four is related to the heart center after it all, you know, it's the central one, the fourth chakra, counting from below upwards. So, yeah, that's interesting. Thank you for that, Magda. Did I see Barbara's hand go up?
Yes. If the stone is a quartz, it holds the pattern for carbon. It has a energiometric patterning that's the same as carbon. And it also has a piezoelectric effect of just a little slight pulse of electricity. So it may be something of the origination of a carbon-based solar system.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I like that idea. It's like a, it reminds me of a permanent atom, the way you're describing it, you know, where it holds the matrix in place for the, you know, it has this vibratory pulse that is descriptive of carbon-based life. Thanks for that, Barbara. Okay, anyone else? All right. Okay, next up, it is only after losing its velocity and hence its fiery. Oh, we read this one. Yeah. Next. Right, this is where we are. Born in the unfathomable depths of space, out of the homogeneous element called the world soul, every nucleus of cosmic matter suddenly launched into being begins life under the most hostile conditions. So these aren't my notes, but what I'm getting from this is a kind of description of the analogy of the temple and the incense sticks, which is the temple would represent that homogeneous element called the world soul, and every nucleus of cosmic matter suddenly launched into being would be the pilgrims. Okay, and she's adding further information that these began life under the most hostile circumstances. Okay, so world soul, now these are my notes. World soul is another name for the anima mundi, which represents the active side of cosmic manifestation and which has its origins in the unfathomable depths of space. This is a contrast to the world spirit, which represents the passive side of cosmic life, and corresponds to the Brahman, from which the Brahma emerges as the active principle. Just as the human being, the active principle is initiated on the higher, in this case, cosmic monastic plane. And finally, through a series of countless ages, it has to conquer for itself a place in the infinitudes. The conquering takes place through amalgamation and refers to its effort to emerge intact as a physical entity worthy of being overshadowed by a planetary or spirit, a planetary spirit or logos. When, you know, that's if we're talking specifically about the formation of the planetary vehicles, these globes of matter that are eventually overshadowed by a planetary logos, right? But you could, I guess, more subjectively, you could even look at, you know, the origins of the individual human being along the same lines that that a human being emerging into the human kingdom has to conquer for itself a place in the infinitudes, because it must, through the infinite levels of growth in consciousness, must overcome all these lesser conditions represented, for instance, by the earlier root races and even the early sub races of this root race. Yeah. So it's not literally banging into the other rocks and you know, amalgamating with them, but it's its own form of harmony through conflict, really. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, it circles round and round between denser and already fixed bodies, moving by jerks and pulling towards some given point or center that attracts it, trying to avoid, like a ship drawn into a channel dotted with reefs and sunken rocks, other bodies that draw and repel it in turn. Many perish, their mass disintegrating through stronger masses. And when born within the system, chiefly within the insatiable stomachs of various suns. see commentary descends four. Those which move slower and are propelled into an elliptic course are doomed to annihilation sooner or later. Others moving in parabolic curves generally escape destruction owing to their velocity.
Thank you, Barbara. So I don't think we need to take this line by line. It seems to be of a piece, and it seems to be, it's a teaching on the physical generation of planets. And this style of teaching is really only found in first generation theosophy, in the HPV theosophy. It doesn't mean it's not true, but DK doesn't use this material. That's not to say it's not correct, but he doesn't focus on it. He does give a series of stanzas that describe the involution of the lesser wheels, but the description there found is much more subjective. This passage from the Secret Doctrine Dialogues goes into greater detail on this first generation theosophical teaching on the subject, but I saw a hand.
Yes, go ahead, please, Yvonne.
Well, that reading reminded me of something I saw yesterday on TV about robots that they are developing to send into space to grab space junk, which is circling the planet, at a very high pace and very dangerous to anything we send into space. And some of it does come down and hit Earth. It doesn't burn up coming through the atmosphere. And it's, hitting people and killing people. But this robots they're sending up there, they're developing, has arms, they grasp it and hold on to it and bring it back to Earth to be destroyed. So that just reminded me how perilous this is that they're reading. A lot of them are destroyed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I read an article like that as well, that there's literally millions of little teeny fragments and bigger fragments of space junk that we created that's rotating the planet, and that you think, it can't do any harm, it's really small. But since speed is relative, it can actually, through its tremendous speed, like it can pierce a satellite and wreck it. And of course, then you have more space junk, So thank you for that. Okay. So if there's no other questions, let's take a look at this dialogue. They're always a little bit fun too, because HPB seems to love to poke fun at these people who ask her questions. So let's see what she says.
You want to read her?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Mr. Knightley, were all the planets in our solar system comets and then suns? Madam Wodlaski, they were not comets, certainly, nor planets in our solar system, but comets in space in the beginning. They begin life as wanderers over the face of the infinite cosmos. They detach themselves from the common storehouse of already prepared material, ready for use, which is the Milky Way. For the Milky Way is nothing more nor less than the world stuff, all the rest in space being crude material as yet. Now let me explain to you this. This Milky Way is just the prepared material ready for use, whereas all the other that we do not see, which consists in these clouds of particles, that we can never see any of the forms of that which is the crude material not prepared yet, Mr. Knightley. Then the process of formation is going on at the present time from the Milky Way, Madam Blavatsky. Positively. And having set on their long journey, those comets first settle in life where their conditions are prepared for them by Philhot. That is to say, where the conditions of equalizing and polarity were and beginning actually to form themselves into suns, each of them, mind you, in space, not in our solar system. It didn't exist then. Then each sun, when its palaia arrived, disrupted into millions and billions of fragments. Each of those fragments rolled to and fro in space, collecting fresh materials as it rolled, unlike an avalanche does until it was stopped by the laws of attraction and repulsion and its own weight. Why it should be weighed, I do not know. I simply translate for you what is said in the occult books, and become a planet. After having disrupted, each fragment became a planet in our or some other system, beyond our telescopes, of course. The fragments of our sun will be just such planets after our solar Perlia. He was a comet once upon a time at the beginning of Rama's age. Then he fixed himself where we see, or perhaps rather ought to see him, in London. When he dies, he will burst asunder, and his atoms will be whirled into space, eons upon eons, as though of comets and meteors, until each is caught up in the vortex of the two forces and placed in some higher and better system.
Thank you. Of course, the Milky Way is now known to be the stars of our galaxy, but this doesn't in of itself refute the concept of a repository of prepared materials from which planets in their initial stages emerge. Any thoughts or questions about this? It's old school theosophy, you know, the old school creative system. And in many ways works with DK's concept of the wheels, which becomes spheres in space, but it's just a different set of metaphors are used. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Mm-hmm. Some very critical readers will perhaps imagine that this teaching, as to the cometary states passed through by all heavenly bodies, is in contradiction with the statements just made as to the moon being the mother of the earth. They will perhaps fancy that intuition is needed to harmonize the two. But no intuition is in truth required. What does science know of comets, their genesis, growth, and ultimate behavior? Nothing, absolute nothing, absolutely nothing. And what is there so impossible that a layer center, a lump of cosmic protoplasm, homogeneous and latent, when suddenly animated or fired up, should rush from its bed in space and whirl throughout the abysmal depths in order to strengthen its homogeneous organism by an accumulation and addition of a differentiated elements? And why should not such a comet settle in life, live, and become an inhabited globe?
Thank you. Okay, as to the statement, what does science know of comets, their genesis, growth, and ultimate behavior? Nothing, absolutely nothing. Well, science may have known very little about comets in 1888, but they now know a great deal, including their precise composition. And this knowledge refutes HPB's teaching that physical comets are primordial planets composed of primordial substance, but it doesn't refute the philosophy of unseen causal stages of planetary development, whether this be described as primordial comets or fiery wheels. Also, we need to make a correction in HPB's wording in her next statement, quote, a Heliocenter, a lump of cosmic protoplasm, homogeneous and latent, when suddenly animated or fire up, should rush from its bed in space. Okay, so first of all, in fact, Heliocenter doesn't itself, quote, rush from its bed in space, but rather substance issuing from Heliocenter enters onto its involutional path, with Heliocenter itself remaining unaffected because causal and thus non-substantive. So this makes me think that the it's back away, since I think it's right here. Yeah. That this is the statement we just read is consistent with the idea that Heliocenter is actually, you know, what does she say here? A lump of cause of primordial substance, you know, that is brought to life and then rushes into space. But let's read this. Let's read this Theosophical Glossary definition of Heliocenter, and I think it will help clarify just what this center is. Can we get a reader, please?
Can you read that for us, please?
Heliocenter, from Sanskrit, lion, melt. Melting, dissolution, disappearance from the verbal root, to dissolve, disintegrate, vanish away. A point of disappearance, a zero point, or a point in substance where every differentiation has temporarily ceased. Also the ultimate, present state, the nirvana of the seventh principle, point at which primordial substance begins to differentiate and gives birth to the universe.
Thanks, Tom. Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Okay. Who's next on the list? Anne Veronica, can you read that forth, please?
Yes. The birds of Fohat are many, it is said. He places his four fiery electropositive suns in the four circles. These circles are the equator, the ecliptic, and the two parallels of declination or the tropics, to preside over the climates of which are placed the four mystical entities. Then again, other seven suns are commissioned to preside over the seven hot and the seven cold locus, the hell of the orthodox Brahmins at the two ends of the egg of matter, our earth and its pole. The seven locus are also called the rings elsewhere and the circles. The ancients made the polar circle seven instead of two, as Europeans do, for Mount Meru, which is the North Pole, is said to have seven gold and seven silver steps leading to it.
Thank you, Anne Veronica.
Thank you.
Okay, first, the abodes of Fohat are many, it is said. He places his four fiery electropositive suns in the four circles. These circles are the equator, the ecliptic, and the two parallels of declination, or the tropics, to preside over the climates of which are placed the four mystical entities. So the suns of Fohat are specific delineations of electrical fire, which demonstrate as different forms of electrical force on each of the seven subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. On planet Earth, we're here being told, the great unmanifested source of electricity called Fohat places four of its suns on the plane of the equator, on the plane of the ecliptic, which is the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun, as well as on the plane that intersects the Earth at 23.5 degrees north of the equator, called the Tropic of Cancer, and the plane that intersects the Earth at 23.5 degrees south of the equator, called the Tropic of Capricorn. For the purpose of presiding over the climates of these regions, which, as you can see from this chart, are in fact quite distinct, these climate regions. These are the four circles, which are the abodes of the four, quote, electropositive sons of Fohat, here called the four mystical entities. This is very occult teaching. I think it's heavily blinded. It hides more than it reveals, suggesting that the persistent climates of these regions is by design and is created and maintained by these four Fohatic entities. But I just find the whole thing quite peculiar. You know, the sons of Fohat, as given to us by DK, represent the nature of electricity on each of the cosmic physical planes. You know, for instance, on the atmic plane, it is sound. It is the sound going forth. On the Buddhic plane, it is color. Right. And so it has a very different manifestation at each level. So it's odd to me that, you know, you would have this teaching that they represent these physical areas of our globe. So I'm thinking there's some hidden teaching in this. And I can't really rectify that. Just have to go with what she says and try to figure out what she means. Okay, next, then again, other seven suns are commissioned to preside over the seven hot and seven cold lokas, the hells of the orthodox Brahmins, at the two ends of the egg of matter, our earth and its poles. So here's a chart of the 14 lokas, which are the seven hot and the seven cold areas. Which are further categorized as heavenly, earthly, and lower lokas. Bur loka is the earth plane and the realm of human beings. Satya loka is the abode of Brahma, where souls are released from the cycle of rebirth. That would be, you would achieve this at the fourth initiation. The lower lokas are the abodes of various demons and nagas. And then finally, we have the seven lokas are also called the rings elsewhere and the circles. The ancients made the polar circles seven instead of two, as Europeans do. For Mount Meru, which is the North Pole, is said to have seven gold and seven silver steps leading to it. So let's take a look at HPB's commentary from the Secret Doctrine Dialogues. That references this section. Can we get a reader, please? Again, we have Mr. Keitley.
Okay. Mr. Keitley, the abodes of Fohat are many. It is said, etc. Reads from the Secret Doctrine, page 204. Question 14. The ancients made the polar circle seven instead of two. Are we to assign four of these to the North Pole and three to the South, or at the seven lokas counted from the equator, North and South? Madame Blavatsky. The Brahmins gave seven to the top and seven to the South Pole. The South Pole represented the seven Rakas in Mithila, but their idea of hell was not our idea. There was a place of rejoicing. When went to hell, he said he never had more pleasant time, just like one going now to the Paris exhibition. And he learned his wisdom. his astronomy there from the Sesha, the serpent of eternity on which Vishnu sleeps. And that serpent gave him hospitality and taught him astronomy magnificently. That is where you ought to go and learn. To hell.
Yeah, you see, you have such a completely different worldview in the Hindu, right? It's hell is just simply the realm of active intelligence, you know, which characterizes the personality aspect. So, you know, it's not a place, it's not an unpleasant place, you know. In fact, we are living in it, right? So yeah, she had a little fun with him on that. Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
What? Yes, Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
The strange statement made in one of the stanzas, the songs of Fohat and his sons were radiant as the noontide sun and the moon combined, and that the four sons on the middle fourfold circle saw their father's songs and heard his solar selenic radiance, is explained in the commentary in these words. The agitation of the Fohatic forces at the two cold ends, north and south poles of the earth, which resulted in a multicolored radiance at night, having then several of the properties of a kasha, ether, color and sound as well. Sound is the characteristic of a kasha, ether. It generates air, the property of which is touch, which by friction becomes productive of color and light. Vishnu Purana.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne. That's a very esoteric passage. First, the strange statement made in one of the stanzas, quote, the songs of Fohat and his son were radiant as the noontide sun and the moon combined. So the songs of Fohat sound forth on the Atmic plane, whereon intelligent electricity manifests as sound. Fohat is song-like because sound on the Atmic plane manifests as beatitude, as we can see here in the DK's list of the senses, which DK describes in TCF as sound realized as a raison d'être, or the source of being. His sons were radiant as the noontide sun because Fohat is primordial light, that is to say, the source of the source light of the third aspect, whose dual nature is represented by the solar lunar or sun and moon. Next, and that the four sons on the middle fourfold circle, quote, saw their father's song and heard his solar selenic radiance. Since the domain of the four suns are the equator, the plane of the ecliptic, and the two tropical zones, we can assume that the middle fourfold circle is the earth. Saw their father's songs, as a poetic way of saying, understood their father's directive, that father being Fohat, unmanifest. Note that they see sound. The term selenic means lunar, or referring to the moon. Thus, solar selenic radiance would be the third aspect solar lunar light, which is the light of Fohat. Again, we have a synesthetic combination as the suns hear their father's radiance. Next. Is explained in the commentary in these words, quote, the agitation of the Fohatic forces at the two cold ends, north and south poles of the earth, which resulted in a multicolored radiance at night, have in them several of the properties of akasha, ether, color and sound as well, is explained in the commentary. This passage references an unpublished probably etherically precipitated commentary available to HBB during the time that she wrote the SD. The passage itself suggests that Fohad, which is a manifestation of Akasha, DK tells us that, is responsible for the northern and southern lights. HPB also seems to suggest that these two borealises are a demonstration of the four sons of Fohat, quote, seeing their father's song and hearing his solar selenic radiance. And why not? Next.
Can I just say something? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, use your hand if you can.
I can't. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, that's all right then.
This is Ariane.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Just the way I experience sound myself is through my whole body. And like the body is a drum, especially with my neighbor's noise. So it's something. So when we think of sound as a vibration, then we have an experience of how light or radiance is also a vibration. Like when you stand very close to someone that you do not know and you feel a vibration, you know, obviously there's something beyond the body, etheric, you know, auric, whatever it is. And that thing is to be experienced in more than one sense. It's a force, it's tactile, it's physical, it's a vibration, it has a level of refinement. I mean, people unconsciously experience this, like in other cultures outside of America, people sometimes in the East stand much closer to one another and we don't like that. So we have some sense of it, but I think that it is developed. It just develops because one becomes very aware of color as a vibration, color as a force, color as a that affects moods and emotions. And so I think this is where we get a doorway or inkling of how one could have synesthesia.
Absolutely. Yeah, real good thoughts. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're just not taught as children, you know, at least I think more and more this is happening now, but certainly I wasn't, that these other ways of receiving information are right there for us to do. And if, you know, our environment provided the possibilities for understanding these new ways, then we would have had a lifetime to develop them. But we tend to, you know, go with the flow, and only when something becomes either, you know, we come into a new arena, a new environment where this information becomes available and we open ourselves to it, you know, or we have a sudden breakthrough in our own equipment and you just can't deny it. And you then have experiences that aren't categorized by the usual sensory perceptions. But I think all of this is going to change very quickly as we move in further into this century. You know, the seventh ray continues to replace the sixth ray, and you're going to have a different type of sensory apparatus developed in the people that come. Thank you for your thoughts, and we're out of time now, so we'll pick up with this sentence when we come back next month. So thank you all for attending. Do you have any dates to give, BL?
Yes. We're a little off kilter with this one because we moved it from the 3rd to the 4th. Sunday, but the next STOA is going to be 1 September. The next Sacred Doctrine.
Which is Sunday, right? It's 1 week.
Yeah. The next Sacred Doctrine will be 15 September, back on schedule. And the next Treatise of Cosmic Fire is going to be 13 September.
Right.
So yeah. We hope to see you all there.
Yeah, and if you can't remember these dates, you know, many of you are on the mailing list, but if you're not, you know, go to moriafederation.com, look at the calendar. That's probably the best way to keep abreast of all the different stuff going on. So, yeah, thank you all for attending, and we'll see you next time. I'm going to check the chat box out now.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, BL. Thank you, Francis.
You're very welcome.